Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, jumping in to tell you about this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food roundup. This week, we're introducing you to some amazing women taking a stand.
So often, being sexually harassed feels like a loss of control. And so I wanted to have these very tangible guides to say, here's what you can do.
Others are pushing for more diversity at major food industry events.
I still feel really determined to do, you know, whatever I can to help shift that and in a direction that's not just more diverse, but more equitable.
We also have a report on that summer business staple, the lemonade stand.
The lemonade stand might be the purest form of starting a business. Low overhead, easy to get into, and requires little experience or special equipment.
Don't miss Meat and Three, your weekly 15-minute food news roundup from HRN. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Search MEAT plus sign THREE. And thanks, as always, for listening.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I speak to someone who I admire, who has managed through life's ups and downs, careers, twists and turns, and ended up at a place that I find completely intriguing. Today, my guest is someone who is an extraordinary baker, something that I am definitively not because it requires both attention and precision, two things that I don't have a lot of regard for, or I have regard for them, but they don't like me, as well as a collector of vintage cookbooks. And she just has a brand new book called The Vintage Baker. So welcome, Jessie Sheehan.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you here because I don't know if there's such a thing as a make good in podcasting, but that's actually what we have here today, folks, because Jessie was coming to be on my show 2 weeks ago, and she was done in by the BQE. And I got these texts. I'm going to be 10 minutes late. I'm like, there's no 10 minutes late on live podcasting. I'm thinking I'm going to be riffing. Yeah. Maybe it's going to be the Dana show. I've never tried to do the Dana show. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's going to set me free. And instead I was like, are you kidding me? Let me see if I can get a guest in 30 seconds. So I did. I got a guest in 30 seconds. Thank you. Shout out to Katie Mosman-Wadler. So actually, we could start with the thank you, the reparation gift, right? So I get home. I'm like, you know, I felt worse for Jessie than for me because she was the one stuck on the BQE, and I was just in this fantastic studio. But the next day, in a pastry box with a red and white, I guess, what is that called? Like pastry twine?
Yeah.
Twine. So this wonderful box arrives at my house. And inside are cookies, and they're potato chip crusted cookies. Do you find that the solution to everything is cookies?
I sort of do, but it could also be cake or it could be brownies. I think sweets are always a good, I'm so sorry, I can't believe I did that to you kind of thing.
And do you ever feel like, wow, you know, maybe they don't like sweets. Maybe that, you know, what has the sugar movement affected you?
I know, right? Well, I think I try to just block it out. If the movement is affecting me, I'm not aware of it because I'm just plowing on through with my sugar and my gifting of it to people. And when people tell me, I'm a generous person, but when people say like, oh, you know, that's so sweet that you want to send me something, but I don't really like sweets. I just am like, okay, I'm crossing your name off the list.
Right. They're not your friends anymore. Like, I can't relate to you.
Exactly.
We don't have anything in common
exactly.
anymore. Right. And today you brought sweets. So what did you bring?
So today I brought chocolate walnut marshmallow fudge with sea salt.
Let's open that. Oh, that was not drop the mic. That was drop my phone. That was amazing.
from my book. And what I love, it's funny, I'm not actually a big fudge person, but one of the things I did when sort of compiling the recipes for my book was I tried to look for recipes that I found in vintage booklet after vintage booklet, and fudge is definitely one of them.
And why do you think fudge was so popular? I mean, I feel like when I go to those old-fashioned candy stores
totally.
On boardwalks, you know, there's the fudge that has been handmade and then
totally.
You know, cut. Like, what is it? What was it about the time? And
well, it's funny. The recipe that I have in my book, and you can pull the bow.
Because
I didn't double tie. I didn't double knot. Poor Dana is like struggling with my box, and I'm not even like a fancy twine tire.
I'm just going to keep going
okay,
silently
good,
here.
Good. I think it can. I mean, some fudge recipes definitely call for a candy thermometer and can be a little on the complicated side. But a lot of the old recipes that I found, like this one, are really super simple to make. Like, this does not require a candy thermometer. And I feel like,
oh my God, we have to stop now. Okay, this is amazing, people. And I know it's radio, so you can't see it, so I'm going to describe it to you. So imagine it's the size, one piece is the size of a generous marshmallow. Inside, there it is as if it is a mosaic. It's a three-dimensional mosaic. So imagine, you know, you're in a temple in Greece and you're looking at a mosaic floor. It's three-dimensional. And in those three dimensions, so instead of chips of glass, you have chips of marshmallow, you have chips of walnut, you have this beautiful, gigantic salt. And I haven't even taken a bite of this and I'm drooling. And is there something else?
I think it's
crunchy.
Just the what you're seeing on top, though, is a little turbinado sugar as well as the salt. That's the sort of light brown.
yeah.
But yes, one thing I did want to mention is Dana is right. The pieces are large. And I'm, again, it's like the people who don't like sweets aren't my friends. The people who like tiny desserts aren't really my friends. I am really into like big cookies and a large slice of cake. And if you're going to eat fudge, like eat fudge.
Okay, but hold on. That must make people so angry because you can say that and you are tiny.
Right.
Why are you tiny?
Okay, I'm tiny. People always ask me that, but I guess that comes with the job. I'm sure they ask you as
they
well.
They ask me all the time.
Yes.
So I have an answer.
Oh,
what's
good.
Your answer?
Okay, I want to hear yours after mine.
Yeah.
Okay, my answer is this. I'm like really most of the time very disciplined.
Yeah.
What I always say when I'm baking is that if something works, I can have a tiny nibble of it and put it away. If it does not work, I can't stop eating it. So there are those moments, but that is all sort of within the world of me being a very kind of exercise kind of person. Like
you look like an exercise person.
Yeah, I mean,
what is your exercise of choice?
You know, I mean, just the way I like my sweets, like fast and dirty and easy. Dirty in quotes, guys, not really dirty. I like to exercise like in my basement or like go for a run. I don't belong to a gym. I don't like spin. I've tried different things, but I like efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to wake up in the morning before I have to get my kids up,
mm-hmm.
exercise, get it out of the way, done. If I wait, I can't do it at the end. I'm a morning person.
Right.
How about you?
I hate exercise.
Yeah.
And I'm trying now to commit myself to it. So I'm trying to do 20 minutes of yoga a day.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that out loud right here so that anyone who sees me can say, hey, how are you doing with that 20 minutes of exercise? Are you really still doing 20 minutes of exercise? And knowing someone might ask me that, maybe I will continue to do 20 minutes of yoga a day. But I want to go back to this notion of being disciplined.
Yes.
And you're disciplined in eating the sweets. Is that sort of your mantra in your life? Like, are you, do you live every part of your life in a disciplined way?
I mean, it's so funny because I kind of wish I was kind of less disciplined and more spontaneous and like more like you know, an artist who just like kind of whatever whim one follows, one just follows it, or whatever whim that comes your way, you follow it. But I'm the opposite. I mean, I it's so boring, and like, much to my husband's chagrin, who is a more of a spontaneous person than me, I have like routines. I like to do the same thing. I like to eat the same things. I like to do the same things. I'm very much a person who likes things on the regular.
Okay, so if you like things on the regular, when you're developing recipes for a cookbook, you're creating new things every day.
Yeah.
Right? So you're trying new things. Does that test your resilience?
It's so funny. That's a really good question. I would say that, again, when things go well, no. I'm like, oh my God, it's so fun. I love my job. When something goes poorly, and I this is probably true for all recipe developers, but I get very sad very fast. Like, I'm not able to say like, oh, I screwed up the brownies. Okay, I'll try again. I'm like, oh my God. Like, I get
it's emotional.
Yes.
Is that because you blame yourself, like, I'm such an idiot? Like, how did I not?
Yes.
Because I should have known. Like, I've made something like this a million times.
Well, that's what, I have a little bit of this fraud complex thing, which, you know, I am slowly trying to whittle away at. But I think what happens to me in the moments when the brownies don't work, or I screw up, you know, the caramel. Like, caramel.
Caramel's really hard, though.
It is, but I should be able to make it with my eyes closed. And when I was testing the recipe, because I have a salty, a salt and pepper caramel in my book, and when I was developing that recipe, sometimes I would get it exactly right, and sometimes I would completely ruin it. But what I was going to say is that I think when that happens, rather than be able to say, oh, shit happened.
Can you? Yeah, you can swear.
Okay.
It's okay.
Shit happens. Instead, that's good because I kind of like swearing. I like big desserts and swearing, and I'm very rigid. that's me in a nutshell, guys. Okay. Goodbye. No, only kidding. but what happens to me is I just immediately question myself. So I'm not able to kind of, I think I like to think that I could get to the point where it'd be like, oh, I screwed up the caramel. Okay. That sucks because I don't want to make it again. But it's not like a come to Jesus moment, like I'm in the wrong field.
Yeah.
And one thing else,
how do you solve the problem? Because really, your job is as a creative person. You have to have the cool idea, like these ridiculous, I think it's funny you call them fudge, because they're really something else.
Yes, it's true.
There's so many things.
Yeah.
I always think of, you know, fudge is just like a block of chocolate.
Yeah.
This isn't a block of chocolate. But creativity, right? Because to come up with that, you need a lot of creativity.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it really is problem solving. And in baking, there's so much problem solving.
Yeah. It's funny. I have, this is like, I think I've lost count, but I think this is my third career. And I used to be a lawyer. And I feel like the kind of nerdy, you know, pencil pushing. I'm not coming up with the right adjective to describe me as a lawyer, but all of the skills that were necessary for being a lawyer and being very things you were saying that you don't love, but being very precise and being able to like really enjoying research and being able to really delve into it. So I'm not happy when the brownies don't work out, but I'm very comfortable like jumping in front of my computer or jumping into my cookbooks and like trying to troubleshoot and, you know, writing out what went wrong and sort of seeing what I did wrong.
So where do you think the fraud complex comes from?
Such a good question. I think for me personally, I'm sure it's different for everybody. I think for me personally, it's just how I'm wired. Uh-huh. Like I was an actress before I was a lawyer. Like no matter what I've done, I've always felt like I didn't quite belong. I felt pretty good in law school, I think, back to this idea that I actually really like school. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, like all these qualities are not like leading up to a very interesting person. I love school. I follow direction. But anyway, but I loved school. I sort of felt confident up to a degree. But in some ways, I think it can make you, as long as it's not debilitating, it can make you a more interesting person.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, because you have some humility about you and you approach the world and the people around you in a really different way than if you walk in like, I'm all that and then some, versus like, ooh, okay, how? Let me read the room. Like, what, do I belong here?
I think it's interesting to think about the fact that your path has been a wiggly one. And, you know, I'm really interested in people's next steps, mm-hmm. how they figure out what to do next. And I wonder whether that sense of not belonging or the sense of, you know, not fitting in or being a, like, you know, air quotes, fraud, is how you ended up having multiple careers.
Yeah.
Are those things linked, or like, how did you decide to become an actress?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think the being an actress just sort of came out of doing it like literally as a child, and then following that through. So that was like not a very, I mean, unless you can have a well thought out decision when you're 10.
Well, some people do.
I know,
right? Yes, Angela Dimayuga from. Who's now at the Standard, who was at Mission Chinese, knew at 10 years old that she wanted to be a chef. And I, she was on my podcast last week. You guys should listen in, because listening to someone who knew what they were going to do at 10 years old is pretty dazzling.
Well, it's incredible. And I was telling Dana earlier that I listened to that podcast actually today. And I am so impressed by that. Because, yes, I was pursuing this thing from age 10 on, but not with a lot of, is this really going to work for the, again, those qualities that I'm mentioning that kind of describe me are not great in a world of the theater, let's say, where not meritocracy isn't always recognized. So you can work so, 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 so hard and yet not get where you want to be. One thing I would say about food, which I don't know, I mean, probably people will disagree with me, but I do think there is a meritocracy of sorts. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there is a lot of luck and there is a lot of who you know, and I've had both of those things in spades, so I would never say I haven't. But there's also, you do sort of feel like, wow. And then back to the fraud complex thing, I'm just sort of being able to see, like, wow, I'm making things and people are actually liking them. That's so cool. I had no idea.
Right. I think in the same way one becomes more confident when one does things over and over again, I think that you can really chip away at the fraud complex if you have just streams of people either in, you know, on social or in person saying, I made this. It was delicious.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing that you're affecting lives and their thank you presents for, you know, when they do things wrong.
Right, right. I have to say, when that happens to me, I'm still like stunned. I'll like scream out to my 14-year-old, like, oh my God, so-and-so follower from, you know, Idaho made my candied popcorn. Like, I still can't like believe it, and I'm super excited and thankful and...
So how did you switch from being an actress to a lawyer? Because that does seem like quite
huge.
A leap.
Well, it didn't hurt that my dad was a law professor. So I sort of always, and there was always this thing in my family where like, you should be a lawyer. I don't come from a family of creatives, let's say. So it was very much like I could be a psychotherapist like my mother, or I could be a lawyer like my dad. And of course I went in... I don't even know what direction being an actor is.
Oh, my God, I think you actually have... Well, the actress, I don't know, but I do feel like the baking splits the difference. You need the precision of the lawyer, but you need to understand the heart and the emotion that your mother must understand. So you're, like, really the perfect blend.
Oh. Back to the meritocracy thing, I was so frustrated by being an actor and feeling like I wasn't getting where I wanted to be that I decided to go to law school. And I also joke that I was tired of getting on an airplane and, you know, you sit down next to someone and they're like, oh, what do you do? And you're like, I'm an actor. And they look back at you and go, oh, what restaurant? And I just was like humiliated by it. And it was true. I could talk much more about my restaurant jobs than I could about my acting career. But long story short, I think I went to law school so that when I sat down next to someone on an airplane, I could say lawyer, and that would just shut them up.
That is a very interesting motivation for very hard work.
Yes. Well, I won't lie. I didn't last very long. I went to law school, then I clerked for a judge for a year, and then I only practiced for 2 years. And I joke, I kind of went on maternity leave because I got pregnant with my first son, and then I never went back. So,
of course, that's not such a joke, right? So, and then you fell in love with baking, and you interned at age 38.
Yes,
I was dazzled by that because that does take a lot of humility and chutzpah, right?
Yeah,
because you have to go in, offer yourself.
Oh.
You can be turned down, and you know you're going to be working really hard for nothing.
Dana, I love you because I literally went in and I tell this story that I wrote a note. Like with the owner of the bakery was there, Nato, who's now a good friend of mine, and I told him what I was interested in, and he kind of gave me a sideways glance. He's like, okay, write a note to the head baker. She's not here right now. A woman named Christine. And I wrote my note, and I had like a million exclamation points, and I was so excited. And if there had been emojis and it was a text, there would have been emojis. I mean, I was so... And after I gave it to them, I was like, that is not cool. Like, the weird mom comes in with like lots of exclamation points and too much enthusiasm. So I came back again.
Oh, no.
To try to just be chill. And actually met Christine and said, like, apologies for the exclamation points. I promise I will not, like, momify your bakery. I am actually not as, I mean, I am full of energy, but I promise I won't screw anything up. And I think maybe meeting me in the flesh, when she met me in the flesh, she was like, okay, we'll give her a try.
And how did you prove yourself?
So, bagging granola. At first, that was my job.
Measuring. And how do you feel about that? Is that is that something that's actually hard to do? Like, is it possible there's a
for
trick
somebody
to that?
Like me, believe it or not, that's hard because you're using, I don't even know what you call the machine, but you're using the machine that seals the bag. And I always worried I was going to melt it too. You know, you can, if you,
oh, yes.
That kind of stuff. So it sounds silly, but yes, I mean, fraud complex here. I was worried that I was a fraud bagging granola because, like, maybe there was a skill set that I don't have to do that. But what I do recall from bagging the granola. Was I would be in the decorators section, which in the end I ended up being much more in the main part of the kitchen making things. But in the decorators section of the bakery, there are shelves and shelves of little tiny glass jars of sprinkles. And there was, I did have that like aha moment, as you say, in my late 30s with like two little kids at home where I was like, sprinkles and jars, I'm home. Like it,
wow.
It was a really weird, like if I had, somebody had told me that, I would have been like, really? But that is how it felt. Like, I really felt like, this is where I want to be. This is the... It was funny that I decided to do this particular thing, going into Baked and learning what they do, only because I actually didn't really know how to bake, nor did I bake. I loved buying sweets. I loved eating sweets. I love a cake box, like a cake mix box. So I was queen of all my cake mixes and my fake frostings, and I still love them to this day. But I wasn't really, it's not like I was at home. You know, you read those stories either of people who like grew up at their mother's apron or grandmother's apron strings, and their first word was whisk, and they pulled the chair over and started stirring. And it's, you know, that was, I was the opposite of that. It was like devil dogs, double stuffed Oreos, Pepperidge Farm raspberry turnovers, and I loved them all, and that's what my mom bought us. And, but then, you know, it was more the sweet tooth that carried me into Baked as opposed to any sense that I think I could do this, eh? Or I think I'm going to love doing this because I really didn't know.
That makes it very mysterious
to
me.
Yeah.
Why did you go?
I don't know if you remember these books, but back in the day, maybe they still exist. There were these books called What Color is Your Parachute?
Yes,
and you were supposed to give them to your kid. Like, I think my mom probably gave me one when I was graduating from high school or, you know, and it was supposed to be, I forget what you call those tests. There's a name for the guy who created,
and now there's a really bunch, there's tons of them.
I'm sure. But,
it's the whole industry.
But I kind of gave, I mean, I didn't rebuy the book, but I kind of gave myself that test. I was kind of having like a, you know, a crisis is like, I mean, that's it's a 1% crisis, okay? But I was like, I had been an actor, I had been a lawyer, I had two little kids, I love my children, and I wish on some level, I guess, that I could have been somebody who just wanted to stay with them, but I needed to leave my, I think I knew I would be a better mom if I had some breaks from my boys. It was sort of thinking about what color is my parachute and really coming up with, I really like to eat yummy treats, and maybe I'm going to really like making them.
Amazing. That seems very simple, but it really, yeah. Really, really worked out.
It did.
Yeah.
It did.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about vintage cookbooks. We're going to talk about a little bit more about baking and delicious treats. So stay with us.
From your chalice chest and I bow my head to you.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard
and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com. That time I came all the way out to Hoboken to prove
my devotion. Hello, it's Dana Cowan. Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. On this episode, I have Jesse Sheehan, who is a master baker. After spending a career being an actress, a lawyer, a mom. So she's on career number four, which I admire. For some reason, when I was in my 20s, I said, and I said it for the next decade, I'm going to have three careers. I don't know why I chose three careers. And then I did one career for 30 years. So now I'm on my second or third one, but in a really short succession. Yeah. That's not exactly what I had in my mind. Yeah. I think. But and you probably didn't have in your mind that your fourth career would be as a baker. So you began working at Baked, which is a bake shop that I love. It's in Brooklyn and Manhattan. When I was at Food and Wine, we did a lot of stories with, we called them the Baked Boys.
Yeah.
And I wonder, did you develop those recipes? Because I know that you developed recipes for them.
Yeah, the lemon bundt cake. I remember being very excited to see that in Food and Wine.
That is, it's there are so many people who work behind the scenes in the food world, and it's not because of Natto and...
No. Right, Matt.
It's not them trying to keep you in the background. It's just that happens. And I love sort of uncovering these secret stories. Like, oh my gosh, you made that lemon bundt cake, which was one of my favorites. Again, not that I actually ever made it, but I would go in the test kitchen and be like, oh my gosh, these guys are sick. Like, it's so, so, so good.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy recipe testing? Because you do that as well as...
Yes. I kind of love it all. I won't lie. I like testing. I love being given... I mean, with the lemon cake, that was me developing the recipe. I definitely love that. But I like even testing where somebody's already made their... Because for Mattinato, I've also done a lot of testing. So they have a recipe. One of my all-time faves that I tested for them and that I keep using the flavor profile in different ways if I get the opportunity, they have a rum black pepper. I think it's a bundt cake, and they have four books now. I forget which book it was in. But I tested that recipe for them, and I kind of... testing seems almost, it's not easy at all, but it's easy. It's using different skills because you don't have to necessarily be creative. They're not necessarily, if it doesn't work, they're not, I mean, of course I would offer something if I thought it could be made better, but that's not what they're asking. They want to see if what they've done works.
Right.
And so I actually really enjoy testing people's recipes. I like when somebody says, can you develop this from scratch? Like just come up with an idea. But I also love it when somebody says, so we need something with peanut butter and chocolate, or we need something that seems hostessy. So I find it to be sort of a nice break, as it were, just maybe just using a different part of my brain when somebody gives me half of the equation and I just got to fill in the rest as opposed to the whole thing.
I think there are a lot of people who love food, unlike you. You're like, well, you know, my Myers-Briggs test told me that maybe I should try to be an intern at 38 at Baked. But there are a lot of people who would be interested in recipe testing. I've had a lot of people come to me saying, like, how do I break in? Or they want to develop recipes. I think often their first thoughts to developing because they have something in their head that they want to put in the world. Do you have advice for them? Like how does one do
that? I think it's tricky. And I would even say now I still am hustling for my development and testing work. It's not like every day I open my inbox. I'm like, wow, 12 different periodicals want me to write for them? This is amazing. So periodical, that makes me sound like an old lady, but whatever.
An educated one.
Though. Yes, there you go. I would say that it's a hustle and it's not easy, but, I mean, this is like sort of what everybody says. For me personally, as well as everyone else, it has been super helpful to have a blog mm-hmm. because it's great. It's unbelievable practice. Mm-hmm. And I think in all the years I've been doing it, and I'm not one of those people who's been doing it since like 2009. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't remember when I started, but it was maybe 5 years ago, mm-hmm. Maybe a little more. But I now look back and I'm like, oh, I kind of know how to write. Oh, I came up with that idea. Like, mm-hmm. I don't totally remember. But B, it really hones those skills so that when you're given the opportunity to develop something, your head is already in the space of like, what flavors would be cool in this? And like, how can I add texture to that? And I do a ton, back to the whole lawyery thing, I do a ton of research. So whether it's in my cookbooks or on the, I hate to say it, I do tend to go to the internet more than I wish I did, mm-hmm. even though my books are like right behind me in my office. But I try to do both, but it's so easy on the internet to just plug it in. But anyway, you know, to get my ideas, to be like, has anybody done something with rum and black pepper besides Matt and Otto? What if I did it here? So I think you can hone your skills yourself, developing recipes just for yourself and your blog. Because I'm not one of those people with an insane following, so I feel like, oh God, what do my people want? I do it for myself, and if people come and want it, I'm thrilled.
And have you built a following? Like, has that been something for the blog that you've done?
Yes, but I would say I have focused more on, which I think everyone right now is, on Instagram. Uh-huh. And Twitter and Facebook a little bit. I was late to the social media game, like as a human being. Mm-hmm. Like I was not a Facebook, Instagram for personal use, Twitter for personal use kind of person. Mm-hmm. But when I wrote a book called Icebox Cakes, which came out in 2015, yeah. Also with Chronicle Books. And when that book came out, people said to me like, hello, social media. I was like, what? I mean, I remember I sent a Facebook with no photograph. And people wrote to me like, honey, you gotta like have a Facebook. So I was like a little, the profile picture. I was like, right. I was a little, what? But anyway, I feel like that has helped me build a following. And I think through Instagram, people come to my website more so than people, you know, all those, what are they, SEO? There's all this stuff you can do to make sure.
And you just haven't done it.
No.
It's not.
Yeah.
You don't need to live there. Okay, let's talk about the vintage cookbooks.
Yes.
Do you love vintage everything? No.
No. And I feel I don't want to offend anyone who does, but I am very much not a vintagey kind of gal in either the way I dress or the way I decorate my home or the things I think are cool and interesting. But that's great if someone else is. But I again, kind of like walking into Baked and being like, hey, teach me. I don't know why the covers of these booklets, which is what I collect, is not. Oh. A matter of semantics. But what I collect is not actual, like, big hardcover vintage books, but I collect these vintage recipe booklets or pamphlets that were distributed from, like, the 1890s to the 1950s with, like, the purchase of a bag of flour or a box of sugar or an appliance, like your first refrigerator. And I have a beautiful old Frigidaire. Like, it actually is hardcover, but it looks like a tiny little booklet, and it's so beautiful. But anyway, funnily enough, because for those who know me, it's not like I'm a super, like, design person. The covers of these booklets really speak to me and spoke to me. And about 10 years ago, when I'd first started working at Baked, a little more than that, I was like passed by a junk shop with one of my kids when he was in the stroller, and I like saw these like, you know, baskets of booklets on the ground, on the floor of the shop, and like kind of scooted in, grabbed a bunch of them, purchased them, and was just like in heaven, because the booklets have these covers with like this enormous, back to enormous desserts, enormous cake with like billowy frosting, like on a plate with like layers or cookies or cinnamon buns or biscuits. It's all it was funny. It's like kind of the perfect storm, as it were. It was all the things I was learning to make at Baked. And then which is like an old school kind of Americana bakery in a way. I mean, they do a lot of stuff that's not that, but that's sort of definitely how they began. And then I was seeing the booklets, which were like, oh, these are like these original recipes for all the stuff that I'm learning to make now. And that was kind of super exciting. And it wasn't like a decade ago, I was like, this would be an amazing cookbook at all. I just took them home, started kind of collecting them, not, you know, I wasn't like voraciously consuming booklets, but although I do so now more so. But I loved them, and I loved the way they looked, and I loved baking from them. And as I like to say, they are like the perfect blank canvas for a recipe developer, because all the bones are there, like biscuits, like here's your leavening, here's your flour, here's your butter, you're done. But then you know, and they're well tested, so you know that.
Are they well tested? That's always what I wonder, because I collected, I mean, past tense, but during, you know, the food and wine years, I collected all kinds of cookbooks.
Yeah.
And I would read them sort of as history books.
Yep.
But I rarely wanted to cook for them because the methods are convoluted.
Yeah.
There was the expectation that I actually knew how to make something.
That's,
And so there was no method.
Yeah.
Or the ingredients, you know, it would have margarine just because it was the era of.
Right.
And so I think it's interesting that within these booklets, you found enough information to sort of inspire you. And, and obviously not enough, so much information that it crippled you.
No.
Right? Because it's like just enough.
That's sort of the perfect way of describing it. Exactly. It's like you got the idea to, for instance, as I mentioned earlier with fudge, I might not have put fudge in my cookbook, but I saw so many fudge recipes in so many booklets that I wanted to. And then it was fun to play with, well, like, you can make this. If you put in sweetened condensed milk, you don't have to use a candy thermometer. The recipes in my book tend to be not easy, but simple. Like, I'm not asking for a lot of complicated ingredients or a lot of complicated appliances, which is kind of how I like to cook and bake, even though I love seeing a recipe with a million ingredients, like an Ottolenghi recipe. I love that, and I love eating that, and I really want to go to someone's house and have them make me that.
Yeah, totally. I never want to make that myself.
Right?
I definitely choose my recipes by length of list.
Me too.
Or if I can see a shortcut within it.
Yes.
You know, if there's like 9 ingredients, I'm like, oh, they just made pesto. Yeah. Fine. I can just, you know, add a pre-made pesto and then call it a day, and then continue to make this lasagna.
Yeah.
That seems very easy, aside from that.
Yeah, totally. So I love that, and I guess just what you said, I see those recipes in these booklets, and I just get inspired. Like, for instance, like, you know, I love, who doesn't, but like a yeasted like morning roll or cinnamon bun. What I loved about the recipes I saw in my booklets was not that they were doing anything outrageous, but it was that they called them curls. And I love the names. Or fig Newtons. I'm not actually even a fig Newton person, although I've kind of been converted, but they called them fig pincushions.
Oh,
and
that's so
just
beautiful.
Love the name.
There's a cloud. There's some silver clouds. And
yes, I have a cake called the silver cake, and it has pink frosting. So I say with pink frosting, but white cakes that didn't call for yolks were called silver cakes or pennywise cakes or full moon cakes. And again, maybe I wouldn't have put a white cake in my book because I tend to be a little bit more of a chocolate girl. Although when you write, you do have to try to accommodate more than just yourself, FYI. but I might not have gotten so excited about this particular white cake, but I did because I love the name. Or sand tarts are like little almond cookies that look like a sand dollar because you place the almonds on the top of them in the shape of a sand dollar.
Reading those, reading the names in your book, it made me want to make art from them, you know, because they're so beautiful, and I feel like they just belong on posters, just as the words and color and, you know, something like that. So you've had this wiggly path that's led you to something that you really love and to this book, which everybody should buy because you will love that too. I know that, you know, it doesn't actually sound like the easiest thing, right? Because to keep self-correcting.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, like, you are at the pinnacle and you're still hustling.
Yeah.
What do you feel like the qualities are that, you know, contribute to the success that you've had and sort of never stopping?
I think the never stop. I mean, I'm dogged, so I will keep... You know, if I see something that I think I want, for instance, someone I'd like to meet or someone I'd like to write for, at least, you know, I try in a very polite but, you know, eager-ish way to let it be known that I want that and to try to figure out who I know that might know that person that could help me, or whether I just you know, shoot someone an email that I don't know or find out if I could be introduced to someone. So I feel like I'm good at putting myself out there. That maybe that brings me back to the actress in me. I don't know. I have like a facility with just, I'm inside, of course, like terrified, scared, like sweaty armpit style. But on the outside, I'm good at sort of, I think, putting forth a bit more confidence. And I like meeting people and hanging out, and I can be good at the, I think, at the sort of schmoozy aspect of all this, which I won't lie and is a bit depressing, but plays a part in sort of helping build your, you know, following, helping getting to know the people that you need to know living in New York City and in the industry. And of course, the people I'm really drawn to are people that are more like me, with like some humility and self-deprecating and funny and la 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 la. But they're all different kinds of people, and I feel like I'm open to all of them. But I'm a hard worker, and I it's hard for me to stop, which can be both good and bad.
And what does that, like, what does that mean to you?
Just meaning, like, at night I tend to go back to my computer, mm-hmm. and I kind of wish I didn't. Mm-hmm. I try not to. I have a 14-year-old and a 13-year-old, and that sounds more dramatic than it is, because my 14-year-old is about to be 15. But if they're busy and they're doing their homework, I'm not going to – I'm happy to go and do my, quote, home – air quote homework as well. I just have – I have trouble turning it off.
Yeah.
And I do feel like it's kind of funny that I ended up being – which is really what I am – a freelancer again. Because why I left – part of the reason I didn't want to be an actor was because I wanted a 9-to-5 job. I really did.
You thought you did.
Yeah.
And then I did it. Turned out maybe you didn't.
Yeah. And so I find it funny. I was saying this to my husband the other night. Like, why am I like right back at it? Because the book came out on May 15th, so it's still brand new. But and I'm so thrilled with the response and excited about it. But I'm the kind of person who's already wondering and worrying about the next thing, which I hate about myself. Like, I wish, I mean, it's so like yogi, and I'm not a yogi, but I really want to live in the moment. I really want to enjoy what's happening right now. And I know that's what I would tell anyone else who was in my position, but it's hard. I can't quite stop.
So I bet there's a way to do that. Do you meditate?
No, but my husband just started. He did years ago, and he just started doing it again. And he's like, "This is incredible. You have to.
You're going to have to do that. Like after this, you know, podcast, you're going to go home, and you're just going to. You can put the same amount of energy into meditation.
Do you meditate?
I do a little.
Yeah,
it's part of my trying to put some structure into my life.
Yeah,
and I really, really enjoy it. Like, I was surprised because I also have that don't stop gene.
Yeah.
I'm not to your extreme, actually, but but I find it kind of helpful.
Yeah.
And it seems like it would be awesome for you to try.
Yeah.
Another thing that we have in common, and I don't know if this is a good or a bad way to end a podcast, but Jesse and I have a mutual friend. So we have all these funny little touch points because I had tried her baking, not even knowing it, because she was working at Baked Bakery when at Food and Wine we were working with the team there and publishing the recipes. And we have a friend in common, and I had what I call my year of breast cancer, and you came to me as a resource. Do you feel like the qualities that you bring to the baking, which is like the precision and the don't stop and the researching, is how you approached that challenge in your life?
Totally. I don't know if you feel that way, but I felt like I would joke that cancer was like a fucking full-time job. I mean, you would literally, when you're first diagnosed and you're like trying to find your doctor, this is so like sad, but I can laugh about it. I think Dana can do. You're literally walking around with like I don't even know what it is, the slides or the zero, x-rays from doctor to doctor. Like, will you guys look at this and tell me what I should do? Will you guys look at this and tell me what I should do? But anyway, so that felt like a full-time job, and I did it doggedly, like crossed every single T and dotted every I and wanted to see anybody that called me and said, I know a great oncologist or I know a great breast cancer doc. I'd be like, oh my God, give me their name. I'm gonna go visit them.
Yeah, did you do that?
Yeah.
Was that harder? Like, I
awful.
Definitely. Awful.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I had a very limited approach. I'm like, I want to talk to the person I trust the most. They're going to give me a recommendation. I'm going to talk to like four people.
Yeah.
I got a couple of recommendations. I talked to two people. I'm like, I picked one of the two. I didn't, because I don't have the research gene.
I think I really have that gene in spades.
Yeah.
And it, I couldn't tell you it served me well or it didn't, because mm-hmm. I think that there are, and I know this to be true, and I try to remind myself this, there are so many, like in any field, there are so many excellent doctors out there mm-hmm. and so many excellent people that can give you the treatment and the help that you need. And I'm sure any one of the ones I met with, including, I had called Dana and we chatted because she had been through this, I think, about a year or so before me, and so had people to recommend. You know, I'm sure they would have been great, but it was like, you know, that need to make sure I had literally, you know, covered every possible avenue was running deep within me during that time.
But at the end of the day, you felt like, I mean, you ended up making a good decision. Here you are. But did having done all that research just make you feel better going through the process that
came so. After? I think so. One thing I will say, this is a little TMI, but I ended up going with incredibly aggressive treatment. So I had kind of an insane chemo. And there were definitely doctors I met who said, you don't need to do that. You're crazy. Please don't do that to yourself. But once somebody told me that there was the hardest way you could do it,
you picked the hardest.
I had to do it because I felt I think that's probably on some way that I could figure out that that's a good quality of mine, but I wanted to do the thing that I felt like was maybe going to ensure the best outcome, despite the fact that I had a lot of really smart people saying, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
So that, I don't know what part of me that is, but that part was very active during that period.
I mean, I identify with that. I did the extreme. I have a BRCA2 gene, mm-hmm. so it seemed reasonable to go to the extreme. And I just did not want, in 5 years, 10 years, to have a relapse and say, like, if I'd only.
Totally.
And I was just sort of preventing that, like, if I only. That I couldn't live
totally.
With. I could live with something coming back if I had done everything I could. Like, there was no other option.
I totally hear you.
Yeah.
I did the same thing with surgery. I went
extreme.
Extreme. Because yes. I just wanted to, again, cross those T's and dot those I's.
Okay, we're going to end on a super positive note. That's positive because we're both, like, here and happy.
Yes.
And we have fudge in front of us. A woman in the food industry who you admire and why?
Okay. I actually thought about this.
Great.
So I have two. Can I do two?
Sure.
I'll do them fast. Deb Perlman, who I absolutely adore. I have worked with her. We've become friends. She's just, in my estimation, a mad genius. I love the way she writes. I love the way she develops recipes. She was so kind and put a recipe of mine for my book on her site, which I was so grateful to her for. And Zoe Kanaan, who is the head baker at Simon and the Whale. And
in,
I think,
Seattle?
No, here.
Simon and the Whale, sorry.
Yeah.
I heard the whale.
Yeah, that's no, okay. At the Freehand Hotel in New York City. Sorry. And she is young, and amazing.
What makes her so amazing?
Sure, she's a baker, and her sourdough croissant and her, I think she has an almond cake. I mean, the list goes on. She makes incredible challah. She just is a master when it comes to yeast and sourdough starters.
And there you've had it. That's this episode of Speaking Broadly. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you'll go by The Vintage Baker. Check out Jesse Sheehan. What's your social handle?
Jesse Sheehan Bakes.
There you go. And you know where to find me, at FW Scout on Twitter and Instagram. Love hearing from you. And we'll be back next week with another great show. Thank you to Carlin. Oh, my daughter just arrived because we're going to go head on a plane out of town. Hey, Sylvie. And thank you, David Tadashore, engineer with the mostest. And have a great week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.